ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And so often, it's not who is right who has won, it's the person that has been the strongest. So you can be wrong and strong and beat the person that is right and weak. And I think the strong part is what the opposition are going for now and just hoping that they've got the right policy to go with it.
My government is concerned with the fight against inflation. Peter Dutton's concerned about fighting culture wars.
And I think if the Prime Minister wants to renege on an election commitment he's taken to the last two elections, I think he should call an election.
The housing system is cooked in this country.
And I was praying that the Minister and the government would finally wake up to themselves and do the right thing.
Hello, welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis from RN Breakfast and Q&A, joining you from Wurundjeri Country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly, host of Saturday Extra, joining you from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And soon we're going to be joined by Nine's Charles Croucher to talk about the week in politics, which had plenty of headlines this week, including on nuclear energy and electric vehicles again. But first, PK, I think we should talk about aged care because the government appears to be on the verge of a major shift in how they fund our aged care system after a task force that was set up to review funding models for paying for this system rejected the idea that came out of the Aged Care Royal Commission that was for a 1% taxpayer levy, like the Medicare levy, and instead suggests moving more to a means-tested user pay system. PK, some people are not going to like that.
No, some people will not, but let's figure out what's going on here. A year out from the election, the government is now facing some really big decisions and some big pressures on things that are more long-term, right? And one of those issues is this big question we have around our ageing population, but at the same time, this big question around intergenerational equity in the way we pay for things, you know, that a smaller group of younger people shouldn't be spending all of the, well, you know, I'm exaggerating, their taxpayer contributions, and they shouldn't keep increasing to pay for an older cohort, which is increasing in numbers, that there is a sort of disconnect between the two. And when it comes to aged care, the facts are clear as the population ages, right? Demand for residential and in-home care is exploding. That's a fact. Expectations that we have as a community are rising, as are the number of people that we need to help and make sure they're in the best position possible, as we should all be as we age. Now, paying for all of this is the big question. And the Aged Care Minister, Annika Wells, said this when announcing the task force recommendations, essentially that the numbers don't add up.
With the number of Australians aged 65 years or older expected to more than double, and the number of Australians aged 85 or over expected to triple, and the number of centenarians expected to go up sixfold, it is clear we must start work now to fund a sustainable aged care service.
Now, Fran, I think it's interesting that we have this young millennial aged care minister in Annika Wells, who's quite across her brief and quite passionate about the area, on this task force. She chaired it and essentially justifying and pushing for what is a controversial yet, I think, in some parts of Australia, particularly among younger voters, quite popular idea that it should be means tested. It should be a means tested system that essentially does put more onus on, if I could be blunt, richer baby boomers to dip into their wealth, the wealth that they have accumulated, which for some, not all, because the baby boomer story is much more complex than that, but for some is big, and contribute more to their care. Now, that's the rationale. Getting it through, though, Fran, and getting the political support for it may be harder.
I think that's right. I mean, it's always harder when you're asking some people to pay more. And, you know, there's still a lot we don't know yet in terms of how would that means test level look like? What would it look like? What assets would be included? Though the task force, I think, has ruled out the family home. But the government, I think, faces inevitable backlash from some older Australians who argue, look, they've paid taxes their whole life. They shouldn't be expected to have to pay now. There are arguments for and against, PK. The intergenerational burden is a key one. You know, young people who find home ownership out of their reach, rents skyrocketing, they've got HECS debts. And when we saw some figures out this week that showed a jump in the number of people paying cash for their homes, and guess who they were? They were older, asset-rich retirees, by and large, with plenty of money in the bank and in their super accounts. But on the flip side, the idea of a tax levy on all of us has been about raising enough money to keep the system afloat at a desirable level of care, and also to keep the government accountable for that spending. We pay the government is the idea, so the government has to put that money into our aged care. It's a system under pressure, no doubt. The federal government funds the bulk of it to the tune of $27 billion last year. That number's set to almost double within the next 5 years. And despite that increase in government funding, more and more private residential aged care homes are closing or threatening to close because they say they can't afford to implement the government's mandated level of nursing care without more funding. So it is a real problem and has to be put on what's called a sustainable footing. But there's an argument to be had, I think, still over this.
And interestingly, I said it's going to be harder to get the political capital to do some of this. I mean, this is just a report. But you're not hearing no from the opposition.
No.
And that silence is interesting because they have the same problem. This is not just a short-term policy fix. This actually really entrenches that privatisation of the Howard-era policy around aged care. It's an expansion in the direction the industry has been asking for, and it will make some Australians suspicious about the private companies who are calling for it. And then, of course, as you say, there's other people, and I think there is an intergenerational question mark around all of this, saying if you're someone with a lot of assets, why shouldn't you be paying more? That is a reckoning we need to have.
Yeah, because it goes to the thing of inheritance, and that just exacerbates the haves and the have-nots in future generations. PK, also this week, the Prime Minister travelled to the Northern Territory. This time he stayed a few days. He handed out a few billion dollars, quite a few in fact, including a 10-year, $4 billion deal for housing in remote communities, and an extra $1 billion over 4 years to fund the Northern Territory's public schools to their Gonski funding levels. The housing agreement was struck between the federal and territory governments, land councils, and the Northern Territory's peak remote housing body. It's expected, or they say it will create 2,700 new homes. It's quite a lot. The schools agreement will double the Commonwealth's investment in territory schools, the public schools, which are under pressure. The Productivity Commission found that 48% of public school students in the Northern Territory experience low socio-educational advantage. So that's what this is about. It means schools would need extra teaching resources to help support these kids and their educational outcomes. So this is a big focus for the government, housing and education. But, PK, is it more of the same?
Yes and no. So yes, to the extent that we are now very much still in the closing the gap framework, which has long been, it started under Kevin Rudd, the same pathway, no big shake-up to the way we do things, but it is a big new investment, and I think that the government should be given credit for investing, particularly in the housing measure, which I think is very significant and at the centre of a lot of problems. I mean, if you don't have a healthy home, you do have knock-on effects from that, yeah? There are consequences to that. Now, the politics here. The government obviously needed something post-referendum. Aboriginal people have been really worried that the defeat of the Voice to Parliament means that the government was sort of almost scared of going anywhere near Aboriginal affairs. Big reckoning, I think, for the government. And there has been timidity from this government since that. Now, they don't feel like they've got the social license from the public after that referendum to do anything big and radical. So they're continuing with the closing the gap strategy. I pushed the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, on this actually on RM Breakfast. Worth listening to the interview on the ABC Listen app because I really wanted to get to the heart of that. What's changed about the relationship, the power relationship, though? You can invest a lot more money, and that's obviously welcome if you're going to build better homes in places where they're dilapidated or they don't exist or there's long waiting lists. That's important. But the actual decision-making about how they'll be run, how do you make them sustainable, what do the jobs look like? And she did give a couple of examples and said the cabinet is looking at and having discussions on this trip about this. about how to change that relationship and empower Aboriginal people more, because she does acknowledge this is a big issue. And she says sovereignty, this idea of self-determination, is at the centre of their thinking. I do think we need to hear more, though, about what that looks like rather than just that it's still a consultation.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it was put many times during the arguments for the referendum for The Voice that nothing works without that level of ownership by communities, input by communities. The people who are there need to be part of the solutions. And that just is common sense, really. But the government is very shy, as you say, at the moment, of putting forward anything that looks like a local or regional consultative model that people could say, well, hang on, we said no to The Voice. So this is a real problem they've got themselves into. They need to start getting themselves out of it. We've seen big spending packages before, particularly in housing. We've ended up with outrageous per unit costs, time delays. Too often these houses being built without input from the local communities about what they need. The Northern Territory Government Minister says things are different now, that there are Indigenous-owned housing companies, there are training companies to make sure not only that houses are built in some remote areas, but these areas also have people trained to fix them, which is important because, as you say, the problems with overcrowded housing and substandard housing and infrastructure are significant and they're dangerous. And, you know, this something does really need to change for good here.
Well, I think this is a good time to bring in our guest. Should we do it?
Let's do it.
Charles Croucher, Nine News Chief Political Editor. Welcome back to the party room.
Great to be back.
Charles, great to have you with us. The Coalition is continuing its push for nuclear energy, really at quite a pace and volume this week. Claims Australia could have nuclear power plants up and running within 10 years. The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, says that the Coalition will name six possible locations for nuclear reactors in the coming weeks. Here he is.
We've said very clearly that they should be confined to areas where we've got a coal-fired generator that's coming to an end of life because of a couple of reasons. One is you've got a brownfield site. Secondly, you've got the ability to distribute the energy that's generated out of that site. We'll have more to say about the exact locations over the next couple of weeks, but we've been very clear that an adoption of the newest technology that has zero emissions is the only credible pathway we have to net zero by 2050.
So, Charles, we talked a bit about this last week, how Peter Dutton seems to be sort of going for broke on this and he's not fudging it. They're going to name these sites. Are you surprised by that?
The fact he's going for broke on it does surprise me a little. This is a hill that he's willing to die on. It's a big one, clearly, because the opposition is sort of hedging their election promises on it, so much so that Peter Dutton's suggesting a debate with Anthony Albanese, which is something he hasn't, I don't think, done on any other issue or topic, a solely focused debate on this one issue. And it sort of goes to the heart of what is a growing problem, and that is that this is essential supply for any person, power, and we seem to have not enough time and too many solutions to the same problem that we can't all get on the side of. The fact he is going for broke, though, makes me think in this debate, because it's one that we've had so many times in Australia, and so often it's not who is right who has won, it's the person that has been the strongest. So you can be wrong and strong and beat the person that is right and weak. And I think the strong part is what the opposition are going for now and just hoping that they've got the right policy to go with it.
Okay, that's an interesting perspective. The opposition is reportedly considering incentive packages for communities that will house these reactors. Yeah, well, I think given the campaign against...
You want something.
You're going to need something.
The hip pocket trick, that's always works.
Things like subsidised electricity prices for local industry, packages to transition local workers to higher paid jobs and all of this. But let's just go to, you know, facts. Mm. Facts matter.
They should.
Don't the majority of the experts overwhelmingly say this is not a good economic idea in Australia?
Yeah, the smart people say that the best thing we can do in Australia is go renewables, but then also back it with gas. We need something to keep the lights on for those times when the basic way of saying it is the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. It's far more complex than that, obviously. But in that transition period, the smartest people you speak to say renewables are cheap in Australia, plus we have land, plus we have resources. This is the way to do it. And they say if you've got gas or another suitable baseload energy provision, then that is the cheapest, in many ways the most efficient and the cleanest way to get us through our energy needs. I thought Kerry Schott was interesting from the business side of things. She spoke at the Financial Review's Business Forum, and she sort of said that she has no problem with nuclear, but we've missed the boat.
It's too late.
Yeah.
I mean, the government's got a target of 82% renewable energy into the grid by 2030. You know, nuclear power as a firming power, as a baseload power, won't be ready 10 years at the very earliest.
Oh, yeah.
It's not going to help with that.
And most people think even that's too ambitious, right?
Chris Bowen summed that up nicely with the "tell him he's dreaming" line from The Castle. I think that's very ambitious. And to go to Patricia's point as well, that the social licence isn't there in Australia at the moment. And sure, you can pay communities for it, but you can do the same to put poles and wires through someone's farm, or to bring a wind farm to a small community, or bring a solar farm to a small community.
There are ways of engaging. Yeah, so there's an almighty political fight going on about that at the moment, which is what I think the coalition is playing into. So that goes back to Charles, why, if it doesn't stack up economically, timeframe-wise, and social licence or political terms, why is the opposition proceeding with it? I mean, cynics think that this nuclear power policy is really about extending the life of coal-fired power and reducing the emphasis in spending on renewables because, you know, there's a lot of people within the coalition that don't support renewables. Mm. But is the Albanese government going to have to do more than just scoff at this idea of nuclear and dismiss it as a joke? Because if it's a disruptor, as you say, you know, the person that argues loudest about it, do they need to argue it with facts around the economics of renewables, around the problems of nuclear waste and the time frame, rather than just say, you know, tell him he's dreaming?
They do, but we don't have the facts from the opposition in the first place yet. This is still a plan to have a plan. And until we actually know where those six sites are, and Peter Dutton said himself, he said, this is an issue of location and cost. Well, yeah. They're two pretty big issues when it comes to any of these topics and what you're suggesting. So I think the government, while you don't want to get caught behind on this, you also, it's hard to argue a hypothetical in so many ways, particularly when there's no detail around that hypothetical. So
one thing too that struck me is that Peter Dutton says that, you know, the cost will stack up over the long run because the government's currently planning to spend billions on rewiring the nation, you know, joining all the renewable zones into the grid. That's going to cost billions. It's true, it will. But the opposition leader also says he's committed to renewables. So presumably he's not saying no renewables. So those transmission lines will still have to be built at some point, won't they?
Yeah, perhaps just not as many. And he also said this week that he can't see a realistic prospect of rolling out 28,000 Ks of wires, which is a huge and monumental task.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at some of the history of governments rolling out monumental tasks. They have been over time and over budget as almost a rule rather than an exception. So the opposition leader is right in that element. However, we sort of always have to accept that all these projects at the moment will be over budget. Look at Snowy Hydro 2.0, like the cost blowouts there.
Not to mention the time blowout.
All of that. Exactly. So again, I just sort of, you come back to, as Patricia was saying, and as you said, Fran, you come back to the smart people you speak to who say solar, wind, and work with those communities, engage with those communities. I think that would almost be the government's plan moving forward. You've got to get into those communities. You see what's happening in Port Stephens north of Newcastle with the fight over offshore wind there. Get in there and win those fights. I don't know whether you have to, you know, out-meme people on Facebook, but meet with the communities themselves. Speak with them, not at them.
Yes, and bring and people with you is the power of politics, right? And good politicians do that. Let's move to where people might need a bit of bringing them with them on another issue. And I'm putting this in the section of this podcast I've described as the climate wars, because the other part of the climate wars is the part about powering our cars. Now, the government is looking at how to best implement its proposed vehicle efficiency standards. It has to drive an uptake of electric vehicles. It's us and Russia. That's where we're the two that don't have these standards. It's incredible. It's got a tight timeframe, though, for reducing new car emissions by more than 60% in 5 years. Now, this is where it becomes contentious. Some car makers, not all, but some, say that it will mean that vehicles will be a lot more expensive. And, of course, that's where it gets very, very tricky for the government. On Insiders, the Minister, Chris Bowen, was sticking to his guns.
Are you willing to budge on the overall ambition here, which is a 60% reduction in emissions in 5 years?
Australia has a lot of catching up to do, and Australian motorists have been missing out on choices. And so we want to deliver those better choices as soon as is practical. And that is the approach we'll continue to take.
Okay, so Chris Bowen, he's open to sensible changes, he says. Charles, how is Labor going to soften the edges of this car policy? Because we are starting from a long way back.
Yeah, we are. And from governments back to the coalition government who had this similar policy or similar ambitions to this one have realised that we are getting left behind and that Australian motorists and consumers are being dudded because of it. It's costing us more to be on the road. There's a lot of talk of, you know, the dodgy models from overseas being dumped in Australia because we're the only ones that will take them still. And then, of course, the cost of fuel for everyday consumers. As for how you soften the edges, and I think it's an important point because clearly there are edges that are about to be softened, the time frame seems the most obvious. Whether we can be quite so ambitious as 12% every year for the next 5 years, or whether you lengthen that out or you bring in the start date later. The other one is the classifications of vehicles. And we've seen a little bit of that already when it comes to four-wheel drives being classified and moved classifications from a normal car to a commercial vehicle or give some kind of leeway around that. The big question is not so much cost as will we have the capacity that Australia and Australians need and expect when it comes to the most popular vehicles in our markets. Now, the initial response to say that's utes for tradies or for people to tow their boats. Clearly, the former Morrison government thought that was the best way to attack this with their claims that would end the weekend. Of course, it's now been proven, and I think most people knew then, the weekend wasn't going to end. But it is a difficult road. You're asking some Australians to cop a bit of pain here. There is a strong economic argument to be made for the government here, and I think an argument they'll be pretty convinced they can win, in that most Australians either want an electric vehicle or see the benefit of an electric vehicle or a hybrid. The biggest preventative measure, the biggest barrier, is cost. In places like Western Sydney, some of the northwestern suburbs of Melbourne, where EVs and hybrids have been taken up at the fastest rate. So it's clear those crucial suburbs like EVs, like the idea of not paying as much for fuel. Obviously, the infrastructure has to come later on. There's all those kind of debates as well. But this is one where some sensible suggestions, to use the minister's words, and some sensible changes that will follow could make this a policy that could take Australian consumers in particular forward. Of course, the big challenge is what do the Greens do and whether they come on board.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. The government has a problem in the sense that the number one bestsellers in our car market at the moment are the Ford Ranger, are the Isuzu
Ute, the Isuzu one, yeah.
Are the Hilux traditionally. You know, these are big sellers, so that's a particular market. So we'll see how it goes. But another fight the government has on its hands is around the Commonwealth Grants Commission report on GST revenue sharing relativities, also known as the GST car. Up. It set off the yearly bickering between the state treasurers, criticisms from some economists that this whole situation has only gotten worse since 2018 when the then treasurer Scott Morrison did a deal to top up WA's GST share, at the same time ensuring no other state was left worse off. That was a political deal done then. It cost the taxpayer a mozza. Looks like the Labor government's just done a similar political deal again. It's really hard to understand these GST formulas. I've been trying to for decades. Maybe you can help. But in essence, is this really just a bipartisan pork barrelling scheme now?
Well, it makes it hard, doesn't it? Like $5 billion, I think, was the figure they were looking at for the top-up, the no-one's-worse-off provisions. Yeah. But it's that WA idea. And to be fair to the people in Western Australia, they had been paying a lot for the rest of us for a while now because of the boom in resources over there. But if you look at the governments, you know, you're stuck in the middle, right? You're fighting the right when it comes to nuclear. You're fighting the Greens to get on board with electric cars. And now you're fighting your own friends in the state capitals to try and get on board with GST. New South Wales will jump up and down. They'll be cranky about this. Look, I suspect the time it took to this to get out, everyone seems to roll on. I think whether voters at home sit there and think, oh, GST allocation outside of WA is a big issue. As you said, it's such a difficult and complex set of formulas to understand.
But the bottom line is the government doesn't want to lose those WA seats it won unexpectedly last time, right?
Exactly. And moving forward, it seems like there's fewer over there as well.
It's,
so
it's a bipartisan stitch-up. Come on, guys. And we're paying for it. Oh, this needs massive reform. But no one will do it because of the way that the seats roll in this country and the political attacks they'd get.
Yeah, but so Queensland's got a state election coming up and they've just been shortchanged. So they're not doing their Queensland colleagues any favours, are they?
No, they're doing them zero favours. But really, I think at the end of the day, as taxpayers, we all deserve to have a better system. This one is not working.
And PK, it will get worse, right? That floor raises. So every 2 years, we're going to have to pay more and more in the Commonwealth because you're going to get more money going to WA. And that's to compensate the other states. Look, again, you're right. Not a perfect system. Difficult to see what the solution is. And this reoccurring political pain from a purely political point of view, every couple of years when the states come back and armed to the teeth and ready to fight.
Mm. Look, I want to do this just briefly, but the Treasurer is giving us a strong indication now of what's going to happen in this budget. And I think it's an interesting indication, which is, hey, ministers, don't go knocking on my door. I'm going to pay down debt. He's quite the fiscal conservative. Is that the sort of what he's trying to send the message about?
Jim Chalmers has always hated the reputation that Labor has when it comes to budget management. And it's something he said before he became Treasurer and something he says in private and probably in public as well. He believes that that is unfounded and that every poll you see when it comes to economic management, the opposition in Liberal Party in general, the brand, almost the DNA, performs better. So he's been particularly disciplined when it comes to not spending any surplus. There has been lots of money coming in because of the high price of iron ore and coal. That's cooling off a little, but not anywhere near like what the budget says. Lots of money coming in because the unemployment rate has had a 3 in front of it for a long time. Again, we're up to 4 now, but that's still low. This budget and the next budget are the real tests of that discipline, because there are portfolios crying out for help. Clearly, people need more help, and we will see some of that. Probably electricity bills, that's the obvious one where you go. Maybe a little help to middle Australia. We've seen it in the tax cuts as well. So this is the big test for Jim Chalmers. You know, he said, I think it was to you, Patricia, that he's obsessed with responsible economic management.
He's obsessed.
On the show recently.
And I did use the word obsessed. It wasn't his fault.
Yeah, well, you led him down the path, but he still took it.
But he's not just a fiscal conservative, as you say, trying to keep, you know, control of those purse strings. He was messaging to his ministers, like you say, PK, but also lowering community expectations, wasn't he? Saying there's not going to be as much money.
No spend-a-thon.
It's not flowing in here. There's no spend-a-thon. And this is at a time when there's a lot of expectation that the government's going to give more help on cost of living. Now, they've already got the stage 3 tax cuts there. You know, there is expectation in the budget that there'll be more cost of living support. And yet he seems to be saying the opposite here, that they don't have money to fling around.
Yeah, perhaps that's a bit of management as well, because the story had gotten away that this was going to be a spending budget. And if you get worried those early statements start to outkick their coverage, well, then you need to rein that back in just a little bit. So that's possibly what this speech today is. Look, again, it is a complex task, right? There are very few treasurers that can return surpluses consecutively, and the government still should do that. But they'll see what's happening in the US, where inflation is starting to creep back up a little bit. Now, it's lower than we've been, and we've seen it, but things are starting to get a little more expensive again. You've still got to beat inflation. That is the number one problem. And if you go around spending on every possible project, plus the extra 15, 20 bucks, 30 bucks people are going to have in their pockets, then there is that little concern as wages are going up that and tax rates coming down, that inflation comes back. And then if that's still around or is high, come election time, that will be politically disastrous. So the big challenge for both the economy and politically is reforming that reputation that has been Jim Chalmers' long-term goal for a long time. He would personally gain from that as well, of course, if he's returning surpluses and being seen as responsible, but then also keeping the economy afloat without propping up inflation to make things worse.
And saving some money for the next budget after that, which will be the one before an election.
Mm. That might be the real test, right? When the rubber meets the road when it comes to election budgets.
Timing is everything. Charles, thank you.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Charles.
We'll move to questions without notice. We'll give the call to the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
Order.
And we've got some questions ourselves here on the party room. This one from Nora, who asks, why is there not more scrutiny of the AUKUS deal? It's shaping up to be a hugely expensive white elephant. PK?
Great question, Nora.
Is it?
I think it could be problematic. I don't think we're quite there yet. But to your question of why isn't there more scrutiny or, you know, essentially of the AUKUS deal, I do think there is scrutiny actually of the AUKUS deal at the moment. In fact, our show has been focusing on it very much this week, and that's because US officials have been trying to really reassure Australia after this announcement in the last week of a cut in production of nuclear submarines. Now, that cut made everyone go, hang on a minute, if they're cutting and they've got limited numbers, why would they give us one of their subs when we are meant to get them? And so I do think that has been in the spotlight, the government's answer. Like Richard Marles, the defence minister, has said, nothing to see, we're working, it'll be fine, it'll be on track. But I interviewed the man who's kind of in charge of this bipartisan AUKUS working group in Congress, Joe Courtney, this week, and he said he still thinks it's not a deal breaker, it's still, he's disappointed that production's down. But he also did say, yes, a new US president could have a different view. He hopes that Trump won't if he's elected, but no guarantees. And that goes to your question about white elephant. Well, there are risks with this deal. People are downplaying them, but a lot of them are hopes that the new potential administration wouldn't change the rules. And hopes are great. It's good to be hopeful. But it's not quite a guarantee, is it, Fran?
No, it's not a guarantee. And Australia's tipping in $3 billion for these subs to be built to help the US capacity to build these subs. And now that seems to be put on the back burner a bit. Malcolm Turnbull said maybe Australia's being mugged by reality and we'll end up with nothing here but having given away our sovereignty and having to basically have US subs in our ports. But we're not there yet. But you're right. Donald Trump is a big question mark here, a big question mark here. Now, if he feels like, oh, well, there's a benefit to the US because Australia's stumping up $3 billion, might be all sweet. But there are other elements to the AUKUS deal, this $358 billion package beyond the subs that are worth talking about, I think, and most of us don't really know much about it. They're about collaboration on cybersecurity, cyber attacks, disinformation, these kind of elements of what's largely described as cyber warfare, if you like, that, you know, does pose a threat to our society and societies more broadly. This is on the rise. We need to be working with our allies on these elements, and this is a part of it. Is it a white elephant, AUKUS? Well, you know, we do need, I think PK's right, we do need to be talking a lot more about it and understanding it a lot more.
Yeah, that's right. But we're not quite there yet. We can't say it's a white elephant, but I understand why people have question marks, and so they should. Well, that's it from the Party Room this week.
Send in your questions. We love getting them. We really love the voice notes too. If you can, record your question and send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And please rate and review us wherever you might listen. I know many people still listen on Apple Podcasts, for instance. We are on the ABC Listen app too, but please rate and review us so that you can give us the boost we need.
That's right. Just because you've been loving us for a long time doesn't mean you can't review us again. Send us up those charts.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.